Chapter 15. Hey, we must be near land, Chief. It was Tony who spoke suddenly. With food in his stomach and plenty of water, Tony had become a livelier member of our crew. He was taking a healthy interest in our progress now. Near land? What do you mean, Tony? I asked. Look at that junk, he said, sweeping his hand around to indicate the gentle swells that rose and fell about us in regular motion, like a sleeper's breast. Bits of debris floated on the hot blue waves, wet sticks glinting. From my calculations, which I was keeping with care, I judged that we still had far to go, but the presence of driftwood was at least a hopeful sign. That stuff floats a long way. It can go clear to the coast, I said. I preferred to be pessimistic today. Well, we never saw any before, Gene argued. That's right, I admitted. I was deliberately letting the boys think they were swinging me to their own viewpoint. It helped their morale. Suddenly, I took more interest. Say, some of that stuff may be useful, I said. Keep a sharp lookout on that debris for anything we can use. It occurred to me that my mind must be getting dull in the heat and hunger and confinement, or I should have thought of this the minute Tony called my attention to the driftwood. In fact, I was a little irritated that I had not seen it first. Tony and Jean talked volubly between themselves, pointing to this and that bit of material floating out of reach, speculating on what it might be and where it came from. I merely sat, stewing miserably in the equatorial sun. It was becoming hotter every day as we moved southward. The relentless heat, intensified by the glaring water, was sapping our strength. There was no escape from this heat, this burning light that struck our eyeballs from whichever direction we turned, and the salt was itching in my beard. As my watch came on, I stirred and wet my hands in the sea to wash my face. Rising and taking my position on the forward thwart, I stretched and flexed my limbs, which now were cramped a great deal of the time in our tiny space. "Put your head in the bottom and you can get some shade," I told the boys. Trying thus to take advantage of a few inches of shade was like drinking from a stream whose banks are just too high to let you lean down and suck up water without falling in. We decided it wasn't worth the trouble. Finally, we caught something from the flotsam close to the raft that looked as if it might be useful. It was a piece of coconut stem that obviously had been cut and used as a paddle by some South Sea Island native. He had evidently taken it from its parent tree with a machete, whacked it off cleanly with one blow. It was about 3 feet long and made a very passable canoe paddle. Such an implement would have been very welcome to us in the calms that were to come, but this one had been in the water too long. It was rotten and too far gone to be of service to us. We tried to use it, but a few strokes broke it. However, we kept it for any possibilities it might offer in the future. We finally lost it when we tipped over. "Wonder where that was used," Jean pondered. The coconut stem paddle at least gave us meat for hopeful speculation. It was comforting to come upon evidence of human life in this waste. As we progressed to the south and east, down through this area, we saw many new varieties of birds and fish, leading us to believe that we were nearer some reefs, at least, where shallow water made good breeding grounds for the fish. Reefs always furnish excellent feeding for fish and marine birds. When these appear in such abundance as we encountered now, it's a pretty good indication of reefs. As practically all the reefs in the South Pacific bulge up into small islands, we had hopes of sighting land at almost any time. "Suppose we do hit an island. Might be a desert island," Tony suggested. "A desert island would be better than no island at all," Gene answered him. We discussed the possibilities and devised a plan. What we had in mind, in case we reached a small island, was to stop over on it, feeding on the eggs from nesting birds, which were sure to be plentiful, shellfish and other such fare as the island might offer. Then, when our strength was restored and we were back to normal, we would stock the raft as well as we could and push on, south and west, with the first favorable winds. Of course, right from the beginning, our ultimate goal was an inhabited island of one of the larger groups to the south. With this end in view, it was our constant endeavor to husband all our too meager supply of tools and clothing, and to maintain our fragile boat in the best condition possible. For this reason, I kept constantly examining the fabric for worn spots and touching up those I found with sparing use of our rubber cement. As the fish became more plentiful, we were learning the facts of marine life. Several varieties of large fish soon appeared, preying on the smaller ones, which seemed drawn to our raft. The big fellows would leap clear of the water in their voracious dashes at the smaller fry, which also jumped wildly in their frantic endeavor to get away. This performance always caused a lot of excitement and conjecture among us. We were always hoping that one of the smaller fish, which seemed to leap blindly away from their pursuers, would drop into the boat. But none ever did, and we were unable to catch another with the knife. We were not too far engrossed in our own suffering to appreciate the teeming sea life about us. On calm evenings, about sundown, sometimes the entire surface of the ocean, as far as we could see, would be one seething mass of small fish. They tumbled about each other almost as thick as sardines in a seine. The flat, windless water, green and smooth as bottle glass in the fleeting moments just after sunset, would literally roar with their frantic churning as a large fish made his rush from the depths and jumped high in the air. The instant the big fish's body cleared the surface of the water on his upward surge, the small fry would calm down until they saw another big one coming. One variety of the large fish always ran three and four in a pack. They were built like bass and looked as if they weighed 75 to 100 pounds each. They leaped 4 to 6 feet out of the water, usually coming out at an angle of about 45 degrees. The small fish were not so terribly agitated by these as they were by the one that was shaped like a torpedo. This vicious creature was about 4 feet long and weighed perhaps 60 pounds. He had a pretty blue stripe down his side, which only accentuated his murderous appearance. His powerful lunge shot him out of the water almost vertically, and sometimes he ascended to a height which I estimated to be 30 feet. When one of these was jumping, the small fish were in the greatest fear and made the water boil as they ran for their lives. At these times, the sharks gathered around in droves to look for wounded fish. They seemed to get a great many. The powerful leaper appeared either to capture or wound a fish on nearly every run. We saw one school of large porpoises. They came up and played around the boat a few minutes, then were off. We never saw them again. The birds had a circus when schools of minnows surfaced. There were several varieties of birds, but the most plentiful were the terns and the white bird with three long feathers in his tail. This beautiful little fellow was a diver. He would get up quite high and shoot straight down at his prey. He seemed quite independent, associating only with his mate, while the other varieties liked to gather in flocks for company. All these birds, except the albatross, were very evidently afraid of the larger fish. They never remained on the surface of the water longer than a second or so. In fact, they stayed on the waves just long enough to grab a minnow and take off again. Always after a long, hard rain, the birds were obviously exhausted. They had to exert themselves to the utmost to stay in the air until their feathers dried and relieved them of the weight of water. At these times, many of them attempted to land on our boat to rest, but invariably were frightened off by the sight of men. As they flapped away in laborious flight, their chirruping was pitiful. By far the most majestic of all, and like the shark, entirely unafraid, as he wheeled and circled in unending turns and dives, was the mighty albatross. He is the undisputed monarch of the air. Like all seafaring men, I have paid some attention to the superstitions of my trade. Many times, as I watched this lordly bird, I recalled the ancient mariner's curse and the despairing line, "With my crossbow I shot the albatross." I still waited for the second one to come, but so far the albatrosses that approached our boat were impersonal in their relations with us. This regal voyager of the air has an enormous wingspread. He is built like a soaring glider, which he emulates in his flight. In a fairly high wind, he hardly ever moves his wings, but takes advantage of the upcurrents from the big swells to sustain him. His graceful movements and almost unbelievable agility in maneuvering were a never-ending source of pleasure to an aviator such as I. I sometimes expected to see him fall off into a spin, but his sensitivity to the point of equilibrium was so great that he could merely slide a shade from one wing, go into a short slip, and pick up speed again in a few feet, thus avoiding what looked like a sure crash into the water. The more the albatross impressed me with his aerial magic as I watched him, the more I came to appreciate the qualities the ancient mariner must have seen in the bird to hold him sacred. It was the next day that we encountered the fateful second albatross I had been half expecting.